Welcome to Developing Leadership, the podcast where I, Iso Kent, and my co-host Jason Warner share our thoughts and lessons learned on engineering leadership through the years. Today, we kick off 2022 with a fun episode where we vented about the things that irk us the most in software engineering and the tech industry as a whole. From the books we love to hate to the leadership approaches we just can't stand, listen to Jason break his record on sports metaphors as we roast some of the most well-known elements of tech industry pop culture and throw in our solutions for some of the issues at hand. Hi, everyone, and happy new year from Jason and I. We're back with another episode of Developing Leadership. We had a great idea for a topic to kick off the new year. Well, actually, maybe it's a little bit of a pessimistic topic, but the idea that Jason and I had was to talk about the things that irk us most in software engineering and software engineering leadership and kind of our industry as a whole. And of course, always with the hopeful and positive outlook that we end up in a place that's better tomorrow than it was today. So Jason, welcome back. How were your holidays?
Great. Relaxing. Spent a lot of time with the kids, and that's what I needed to recharge.
Perfect. So Jason, let's maybe ask each other this question. What irks you most about the space of software engineering and engineering leadership?
Oh, where to begin? I think if I were to kind of sum it up, I think a lot of what irks me can boil down to as one of the root causes, a lack of overall actual professional leadership in tech at the highest levels, but also kind of throughout the organization. And people who have listened to the podcast before, or maybe heard me speak in other places, have heard me say that if you largely bucket leaders and workers in general, but leaders specifically into amateur, pro-am, and pro categories, we are full of amateur and pro-ams. And very few pros actually are in the industry. I think that leads to a whole host of issues.
I couldn't agree more with you. And it's definitely one of the things that irks me as well. So let's maybe start there and then we'll come back on some of the other things that irk us because I know we have a large list. So maybe to start with a very basic question, and I kind of feel I have an answer on this as well. Like, you know, why are we full of amateurs? Is it just because our industry is young or is there another topic?
I think by necessity, to some degree. If you think about it, that we need people at the tops of organizations, and there's so few people who are capable of running a lot of these large divisions and companies. And I think that that's just by necessity. A good example of this is going back to sports. There are 32 professional teams in the NFL. That means there's 32 starting quarterbacks in the NFL. Not all 32 are actually NFL caliber quarterbacks, but there will always be 32 starters in the NFL. And I think that we have a similar problem in tech. We just look at it slightly differently, or maybe not. It's not as blaringly obvious to us because you don't watch it on TV and see the results in the same way. But I feel it's very similar.
So the rate at which tech is growing, right? It's leading to a huge, larger number of demand and also supply that we create of new leadership positions. Do you think the rate at which we're growing those new roles and those new leaders is in line with the same rate at which we're creating quality leaders? Like even if it's a small level at the top, are we still proportionately growing it?
No, I mean, I think we're proportionately growing it, but I don't think we're growing in the aggregate that we need. And I think also what happens is this is where the part of the challenge comes in too, is if, let's just say 80% of the current generation are pro-ams and only 20% are pros, and I don't think it's that generous of a ratio for what it's worth, that means that 80% are going to be training the next generation. And what do you think that they're going to get as quality education? You know, I think that's the cycle really that's going to hurt us the most. And even if we create enough, they're not going to know what great looks like. And not knowing what great looks like is a really, really hard issue to overcome because you could have people who might have the skill, but they just don't know how to apply that. Again, going back to sports, like you could have all the raw skill in the world, but if you can't train against some of the best, you're never going to know what it means to train with the best and what the best look like. And I think about this a lot when I was an operator, I think about it now as a VC, but it's going to be an issue. And then, again, on the VC side now, what I think about a lot is helping the younger generation or first-time founders understand what excellent and world-class looks like.
It's interesting you say this because to me, it touches upon something that irks me as well. And I think it's tangential to this is the fact that I've asked hundreds of engineering leaders What did you consume to learn to where you are at? And one of the things that massively irks me in our industry is they all mention the same three books. And it's not that those aren't great books, but the fact that the list is always three. and some of those books are also, in general, don't apply to every single stage or different type of leader. Why are we in a space where the sharing of learnings is still so much in its infancy? And do we see it changing?
So this is a really interesting topic, I think. I don't know if it has to do with sharing, although I do think that there is an element of not sharing that needs to go into this too. I think about this quite a bit because I get asked a lot, could I write a book? I mean, we're doing a podcast. It's different than writing a book or doing a series of articles. And the reason why I think is that you could write content that speaks to an amateur or a pro-am really easily and get an amateur to a pro-am or a non-practitioner to an amateur. But it's very, very, very difficult to write for the pros and to get a pro-am to a pro because, and this is where it really comes down to, is that all pros realize that the shades of gray, the nuance, the middle is where pros are made. And it's the art, not the science of it. So one of the books that I know that people quote all the time is The Score Takes Care of Itself by Bill Walsh, he's a famous 49ers football coach. And it's an excellent book. If you haven't read it, I do recommend you go read it. The problem is that if you think about this, that book has been out there since I think 80 is when it was out there. Every professional football coach should be an excellent football coach if it was that easy to apply just the words on the page to the situation. And Bill Walsh is excellent, or was excellent. And if you read it, you'll understand exactly what I mean by that, which is there are so many times when you need to make a decision, and it's the art of the decision, not the science of the mechanics of the situation that matter. And that's where the pros and the excellent ones are made.
So let me throw you a curveball here. Could it be argued that to go from pro-am to pro, it really has nothing to do with consuming more content, book or otherwise, on engineering leadership, but that it really just at that point comes down to the common intersection of all leadership knowledge, experience, like that there is as much you can learn from a football coach or an athlete or the CEO of a chemical company. Is there a point where we should be immersing ourselves far more into content that's maybe not written for us as engineering leaders?
I personally think so, yes. But then again, that's my own bias coming out too, because that's how I got better at this, is I studied sports. I did a lot of politics, not because I had an interest in politics, but you have to understand high stakes conversations, high stake risky situations, nuanced compromise, all that sort of stuff looks a certain way. You've got to understand how to pull from other areas and learn from it. So I think so, yes. But I also think a lot of the other industries and a lot of other arenas are more mature with probably more deepened practitioners than we have here. And it's more obvious too. So again, I keep going back to sports, but the reason why for me is because I'm 20 years steeped in kind of studying sports to apply into engineering leadership and company building. One of the things I love about sports is you have discreteness. You have a game, you've got preseason, you've got a game, you've got quarters, you've got a season, you have off season. You have like perfect chances to like redo experiments and, okay, this season didn't work out for us. We're going to go back next season. We're going to change things up. We're going to do some stuff and we're going to run the experiment again. And then we're going to see what happens with it. It's interesting. It's fascinating to see. And then you could read about the philosophies that go into each one of those seasons and all that sort of stuff. You can't do that in tech. You can postulate. I do that quite a bit, but you can never really fully know. So I do think that we should consume more of that information. I honestly do. I also think that we should be much more critical of ourselves and others around us, but in a way that says, not critical as in judgy, critical as in why did they do that? What is a possible scenario? Another thing I mentioned before in this podcast is that I have notebooks all over my desk and I have my GitHub notebook over here, but before I joined GitHub, but what I maybe less commonly known is I have a Yahoo one, I have a Google one, I have a CRM, a Salesforce one. And it's what would I do in the situation that I found myself running any of those companies? And obviously there are moments in time, but I think through and I was like, what would I do? And then I look back years later to see what they were doing, to see how far off, on or off. And obviously I have no idea what the strategy is, but it's interesting. It's data that you kind of like help yourself to like at least course correct to a degree. And I don't think we do that enough. I think most of us wake up every day, look at our calendars and say, oh, I need to have 5 one-on-ones and I need to do this project review. And then I go to sleep again at night.
Okay. So that's, you just shared with me something that I didn't even know about you yet, which is the notebooks of other companies that you haven't worked at. I find this interesting. It almost is like the fantasy football equivalent of strategic decision-making. Tell me a little bit more about what you're doing there. Well, what does your Google notebook look like?
Well, my Google notebook, it was probably, I think I probably did that one in 2016 or so when I was at Heroku. And a lot of it is, okay, so Google, what would I do in this situation where you have the world's best search, one of the world's best video assets, an ad network unlike any other, an underperforming cloud asset, but some of the best tech, one of the deepest research organizations in the world, blah, blah, blah. You just start like, what would I do? How would I take this company? And the goal being that, well, I want to put myself in a high stakes situation and understand what decision making might look like and the trade-offs too, because you can't just say, well, I'd go invent a space division out of nothing. You can say, I need to experiment with it and see what and why you would do all that sort of stuff. My whole purpose there is to stretch myself and to think differently and to push, put myself into a situation. Now, on the flip side, it served me well because I had a GitHub, GitLab, Atlassian. I had all three of those notebooks when I was at Heroku, and that led to me trying to acquire GitHub, GitLab when I was at Heroku, which didn't work out, which that led me to GitHub, and then you'd crack open that notebook and talk about that. What I always said is I really want to put myself in a position where I can see myself taking the top job and understanding how to navigate that company and bring it to success. Good example on the counter here is I've talked about how I interviewed Uber at one point for the top job over there when they're going through some of their struggles. And ultimately, there's a whole category of decisions and criteria that didn't fit for me to join there. But one of them is that I can never see myself being the CEO of Uber. And the reason why is because I didn't really fully understand their business and how to take it from where it was to like this grandiose next stage. And I didn't have line of sight to it. As weird as that sounds, Uber at the time was not as, I think it had just gone public or maybe about to go public. I can't quite remember. I would have a much more crystal clear answer on exactly what to go do in Microsoft or Google or Roblox even, because I understand that business a lot more, or Coinbase, because now I understand that business. But I didn't understand Uber, so I didn't really know what to do with it. But I know exactly what I would do at Microsoft today to make it a $5 to $10 trillion company. It's obvious what you would do at Microsoft or Google these days, it feels like to me.
So it's interesting. You bring up the notion a couple of times of both experimentation and strategic foresight, or at least, or just playing with ideas, in contrast to the fact that a lot of leaders today, like you said, it's the 5 one-on-ones on the day. It's the meetings that are often reactive, not even proactive. This brings to me one of the things that irks me a lot about software engineering leadership is we have a huge culture of experimenting with technology, right? We will try every new thing under the sun, no matter how mature the organization is. Someone will slip in that new project or new library and experiment with it. And it brings us, it gets us into trouble, but it also gets us, it moves us forward, right? It ends up creating new interesting things from columnar databases to all other cool tech that's come out in the last years. But I feel that we have a huge lack of culture in experimenting with our organizational models, with ideas on how to improve things. And I think it partially comes from the fact that by the time we make a decision to try something different in our organization, it often comes from a cargo culting, or let's mimic what Google does, or let's mimic what the blog post that we just read on Hacker News, and let's go all in on it. How do you look at experimentation at the kind of organizational level?
So I think you hit the nail on the head there. And for listeners at home, we had a mini conversation about this episode before, but we didn't get into this point here. So I just kind of read my mind personally on this one. So I think in software, it's easier because we expect an experimental mindset to a degree. We talk about short feedback loops and failing QA tests. And you know what I'm talking about? We have this all the time. And we kind of encourage it. It's the exact opposite with leadership. And in fact, you're not allowed to make mistakes typically. And by mistakes, I don't mean, hey, we're over budget, or I mean, it's like, hey, we're going to experiment with something. It's almost like you have to have the exact answer. And this goes back to my other point about amateurs, pro-ams, and pros. Pros never act like they have the answer. Pro-ams do. And they say, this is the way. And then in their mind, this is the way because Google did it, or because I just read this blog post, or because it's got a recipe right here that I can follow because I actually don't know what I'm doing, but if someone smart said it, I'm going to go do this. Whereas a pro is going to say, our goals are to achieve this. And then we're going to try this way of doing it because we need to optimize X, Y, and Z to achieve these goals. And this will get us to there. And if it doesn't work, we fucking throw it out. That's it. Like OKRs are a perfect example here. I can't tell you how many times I walk into an organization and they said, oh, we got OKRs. Do you want to see them? I'm like, oh God, no, I don't want to see your OKRs. I want to see where the work is actually happening and what work is actually getting done. And they look confused. But you can, if you have a series of 3 hours of conversations with key leaders around the organization, you're going to circle a bunch of OKRs that are not being worked on and a whole bunch of hidden work, not on OKRs. That's kind of critical.
Yeah. And so it's funny you bring up OKRs because we all want to get better. We all believe in setting goals, but for some reason, OKRs and engineering just don't go hand in hand. I have yet to see any organization where OKRs represent, like you said, represent what's actually being done. Why do you think? And it irks me, to be honest, because you read the John Doerr book and you look at OKRs and you see how they can be valuable for your organization. Yeah. But time and time again, they fail in engineering. If anybody is listening to this and they really feel OKRs succeed in their engineering org, hit us up because I'd love to learn more. Why is it, Jason? What are your thoughts on why this happens?
Well, a couple of things. One, John Doerr's, most of John Doerr's OKR stuff, one, is from a factory. And if you think about why that works, it should be rather obvious why that works.
Yeah.
It's a very different type of approach to engineering. It's an engineering, but it's a different engineering discipline entirely. Two, I actually think there's a lot of conceptual things in OKRs that make a ton of sense. I call them alignment tools. And I love alignment tools. I just don't like OKRs. And I don't like, you know, a lot of things about OKRs, but I do love the fact that they're trying to align the organization in a way to have conversations around what's important. Further, I also think that we start to get really pedantic over OKRs because, again, we don't understand the philosophy and the soul of what the alignment tool is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to allow us all to be on the same page about where we're going, why we're going there, who we're doing it for, and the time horizon that we're doing it under. And instead, we start saying, that's worded like a K, not an O. And that doesn't really mean that we can actually get the result that way, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, by the end of it, you just put something on a spreadsheet or a paper so you can end the conversation. It's literally what happens in 99% of all orgs with OKRs. And so, you know, you couple all those things together, and I don't think it works for engineering. It works pretty well for sales. It can work pretty well for marketing. It works in finance. It can work okay. Product, no. Design, absolutely not. Engineering, very minimally. And the reason why is because it loses the soul. And I think that is, as an engineering leader, I understand this. It's very difficult to take an OKR translating into soft engineering. And it's much easier to say, we're going to go over here, we're going to do this time horizon. And then the messy middle, it's the draw the owl. Ironically, it's the draw the owl thing. You understand that it's going to be very messy to go from the sketch to the full owl. But for whatever reason, you know, we as an industry have taken it that, no, it actually can be really prescriptive to do that.
And it's funny because we're going from one thing that irks me to the next kind of within very naturally, being pedantic. We are a space where we look at a lot of these challenges and we get incredibly pedantic about them. And while it makes sense to get pedantic at times on certain technical topics, there's a lot of examples that I see today in our industry that no one agrees with what we all do. Right. So I'll give a very simple one that I see time and time again, and it bothers the hell out of me. Two or three reviewers on a three-line PR that's fixing a typo.
Yeah.
Right. It's one of those things like, yeah, we've decided to have two reviewers on every single pull request, but that's not the soul. That's not the purpose of what we're trying to do.
And this is, I could draw a direct line from this back to pros and pro-ams, because again, like it's not understanding the spirit, the why, the soul, all that sort of stuff. And again, it's an awesome example because if you say it on the surface, of course you shouldn't need a reviewer for a three-line blah, 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 particularly a typo. Yeah. I mean, like there's somebody somewhere listening to this podcast and be like, I could come up with a one-line change that everybody in the organization is going to need to review. I'm like, yes, of course you can. Time the database string gets changed, we're going to have to blah, blah, blah. Every time this gets changed, yes. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the fact that like there's a category of changes where they're so low risk that the fact that we're going to put them into a high burdensome scenario to get reviewed will grind the system to a halt. And this goes back to another book that I don't think we talk about enough for engineering leadership and leadership in general. This is 1944, I believe it is, CIA Handbook, which has been recently declassified, called The Subtle Art of Sabotage. And it's all these things that you could do if you were behind enemy lines in World War II to grind the enemy organization to a halt. And they're awesome ones. It's like reopening meeting topics from last time or making everything about the definition of something. And it's amazing. Just go, you know, we'll link it here in the podcast and people should go look it up. But I think in that way, there's a lot of things in many organizations that are unintentionally the subtle art of self-sabotage.
So I have the feeling we do this more in engineering than even in other disciplines. And I like to think that it stems from the fact that you've probably sat in meetings like this as well. And some of my favorite engineers that I work with today will often push me or push people on our team to give the black and white answer and rule. Because it's what we're looking for, right? Like, does the test pass or does it fail? What are the 5 test cases inside that we need to do? And while that works, well, partially well for code, and I think we're great at testing everything anyways, it doesn't work for these organizational topics. Do you think this is more prevalent in our discipline because we're all across the org pushing each other for certainties?
I think, so this is, again, I'm going to show my own career path and biases here. But I think that it's the difference between mainframe monolithic thinking, where most often root cause can be tracked down to a singular thing, versus large scale distributed systems thinking, which is, there's almost never a certainty because there's a degree of risk in almost every single message being passed across and scenario and failure mode. And if you think about the two different types of systems at play there, and I'm using my hands for the folks on the podcast trying to like show you that you've got a box on one side where basically everything is kind of housed and well understood and like mostly handcrafted, if you think about what that looked like, to now what we're running, you know, I think about GitHub scale or Heroku scale or Roblox scale or like these massive, massive distributed systems where all of a sudden something broke for about 2 milliseconds and everything went haywire and then it fixed itself. And you're like, what just happened? And you don't have an answer for it. You don't have an answer for it. Distributed systems thinkers understand that there is no certainty and they have to try to get to best postulation. And I think that those folks can deal with the ambiguity in a very healthy way inside the organization. But there's a monolithic approach to thinking, which is no, no, no. You need to tell me what the PRD says. I need to have this doc written so I can take it from the spec and write it over here. And I need to know exactly what the stack trace says. Send me the stack trace and I'll debug it. It doesn't work that way. I've said this before and I'll keep saying it. Organizations themselves are like less rational distributed systems. So if you think about it from that perspective, you already have a system that's not very deterministic and you take a less rational version of that. You understand what's actually happening inside organizations.
I love this analogy that you're making because at the end of the day, a lot of our faults in decision-making, and I would even say as humanity as a whole, not just engineering, comes from the fact that we're trying to understand complex distributed systems in simplistic causal or correlated type situations, which are just completely impossible to do. We don't have the bandwidth to do so. And it's like economics, right? Like,
it really is. I was actually going to say it's more like it's a Marvel movie where Dr. Strange talks about the time stone. And yeah, all of a sudden, there's 1,000 different possible realities, and each one of those has 1,000 possible different ones too. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about like we'll just pick the path, and next thing you know, we understand exactly what happens when you do X in 1944. No, that's not the way that works.
I'm going to sidestep here, Jason. Are you also prefer Marvel versus DC? Do I have a fellow Marvel fan?
I am a Marvel fan. I grew up on Marvel comic books. I never really got DC, so big time Marvel geek. And my son, who is now into comics, is a big time Marvel person as well.
Nice. Yeah, DC is just too dark for me. I think it comes from the wanting to have an optimistic view on the world. So if we look at, you know, things that irk us, what are some of the things that we haven't touched upon yet that you wish you could wave a magic wand and tomorrow would be different?
Well, we've talked about this before on the other podcasts as well, but I do think that we need more. I think we need more pros in leadership. I think we need more engineering pros at the top jobs in these organizations, particularly for like a host of reasons that I just mentioned here.
Yeah.
In particular, we need to look at engineering as we don't, you know, I said before, when I started my career, I was an engineer, but I was a cost center inside IBM. That's how it was coded. And like, I was an unfortunate expense that the company needed to hold on to. We don't think about it that way anymore in the industry, but we still think about that as the engineering leaders. We're like, if you can just kind of like not speak up in meetings and just go do this, you know, we would be very appreciative of you. And I think that's a mistake. I also do think that this is kind of a strange one, but I think that going back to what you said about the simple answers, I think that we're too often in this binary world, which is like, it's either or. It's going to be this or it's going to be that. And it's never going to be those things, but I think that we want some confidence around those, but you know, we don't accept the fact that there is some degree of risk. I don't think that we talk about that enough. And then I'll say a couple of other things, like slightly when it comes to like more specific engineering things. I think premature optimizations and the cargo culting that we mentioned before is so wasteful. It's very easy to see about stage, like pre-seed, seed, A, B, C, D, what you should and shouldn't have to worry about there. And if you've gone through it a couple of times, and we've had this conversation in private a bunch, like everyone thinks I'm against Kubernetes. I'm not actually against Kubernetes. I'm against Kubernetes before you get to pre-product market fit, because you've not de-risked your company to earn the right to say that you need to scale to the world. And Kubernetes is great, but there's a set of people in the world who should deal with Kubernetes and not 99% of all engineers in the world. The fact that Kubernetes is exposed out to the random person who's building some marketing website for an agency, that's a mistake. That's a failure. That we shouldn't, that is lazy thinking on how we should have given tools to engineers. That stuff irks me.
I couldn't agree more with you. And to your earlier point, for me, if I could wave a magic wand, it would be that everyone in engineering would be able to understand the impact of their work on the business.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that, it doesn't irk me about engineering, but it irks me about businesses as a whole. And I think it comes to the point earlier of like engineering not being valued enough still to date in certain rooms and conversations. You said this, I think maybe on the first or second podcast, right? Engineering is where the rubber meets the road. You take it away, nothing is going to happen. And it's where so much value gets created. But still to this day, I see so many great individual engineers and engineering leaders that are doing great work, but do not have the ability to get the realization of what's the impact of what they're doing.
Yeah.
And what does that translate to? And it's not always easy, by the way. I'm not saying this is easy to bring up, but it's, if I could wave a magic wand, that would be the one, being able to show everyone what impact they're having.
I agree. I think this is part of like going back to the alignment tools and OKRs too. It's very difficult. And that's what those things are trying to point to. But it's just a very difficult thing for people to break through to. And we don't have the right language around it. Something else that occurred to me that does irk me, and this is going to be, now obviously I'm on the VC side as opposed to being CTO side, but I was irked equally as much on both sides of this fence. I think a lot of times we confuse market capitalization or how financially well-off a company is with how good their products are. And, you know, my famous example here, and I'm not shy about saying it, is Salesforce. Salesforce is a company I would put my money into, but I would be loath to use any single one of their applications outside of Slack, which they acquired these days. You know, I use Heroku too, but they acquired that and they mostly killed it. And it's the distinction of, they're a good company. They'll make money. They've got a great sales team, but their products are terrible. And I actually think of them as user hostile. And I think we should need to divorce the two of those things. You'll see financial people saying like, I love this company. I love this stock. I love what they're doing. Then you have to talk to the users who are like, oh, I effing hate my life using this thing. But we as an industry commingle them. Like, oh, they have to be good, but look how much money they're making. Like, no. Those two things don't necessarily need to be tied together. You can actually divorce them at very large scales in our industry.
And I would even say that to engineering cultures as well. Right, you look at the difference in engineering culture between a Google and an Amazon, and they couldn't be further away from each other in terms of cultures. But we're easy to say that they are good because of the success of the business. And probably the example that mixes those both is, for me, is Atlassian. Like, I absolutely love Atlassian as a company. Everyone I've ever met from there has impressed me. Yeah. But using Jira as a product, which we use, and I think 99% of the industry uses to date, is one where all of us have a chip on our shoulder with the product and the product experience. And so I think it cuts every possible combination. And it's just worth noting that, yeah, the relationship between success does not mean great engineering.
And I think it gets very confused very quickly as companies scale. It's obvious earlier in their life cycle, but it gets very confused later. And I think it becomes almost near impossible to actually untangle them until they get to a sufficient size where it becomes easy to throw pot shots at them, like Oracle. I think anybody would love to have founded Oracle and have been running, you know, yeah, VP at Oracle for the last 20 years. You'd be incredibly well off. But you wouldn't be proud of the product you built. You'd be proud of the money you made. And that's a very, very different thing.
Well, I'll even take it a step further. There are organizations and products out there where you can be incredibly proud of the engineering you've done,
yes,
but not at all proud of the product that's actually been delivered to the end
user. And I think this is where it gets confused again, because you could actually have done amazing work, but you got no customer uptake. And then everyone realizes that that doesn't work either. I get particularly irked when I hear about companies that are just like, hey, the company's printing money, therefore they've got to be a great product engineering organization or have a good product to sell. You're like, no. Let's divorce those two things, and vice versa. You can have an amazing product and it's going to become bad business because they don't know how to distribute. They don't know how to get sales going. They don't know how to go to market. And that's, again, we should make sure that we're having the right conversation and not talking past each other in both those scenarios.
Yeah. And you just said words that I wish were, and this is one of the things that really irks me actually, is you just said product engineering. The product engineering org. It irks me that in many organizations today, it's not the product engineering org. It's the engineering org, and there's the product org.
Yes.
And there's tensions, and they're not speaking to each other, and their goals aren't aligned, and org structures between the two are not leading to the right outcomes, which is absolutely ridiculous because you share the same goal. It really irks me that, and this is not everywhere. I think we're making strides in progress here, and I think younger startups and companies often almost always get it right, just for the nature of them being smaller. But the fact that we're not, that it isn't considered a joint discipline, to me really still surprises me. And I wish we could do much, much better on that.
This is a topic that comes up when I'm talking to very large companies these days too. And so they're asking opinions on this and what I would do in certain scenarios. And I have a kind of a spiel, and I'll go into it, which is, if you can find the unicorn capable, the pro, going back to the earlier phrasing, you can find a pro, you absolutely should put product and engineering and design under that one person. The problem is you can't find that unicorn these days because there's just not enough pros to go do this. So what do? You want to break them up and find three programs, or one or two programs of one pro of a certain discipline, but not the mega discipline. Then they all report to the CEO or CTO or some coordination that looks like that, but usually the CEO. And then what happens? The CEO gets annoyed because those three can't problem solve together and says, you three got to get into a room and prioritize this effectively. No, Mr. or Mrs. CEO, that's now your job. You didn't actually organize this so that one person would prioritize that. You're the one person now. You are the quote unquote pro or the unicorn that needs to make this decision. And that there's a disconnect there. And a lot of CEOs don't know that that's their job. And I'm telling you, if you're a CEO of a couple thousand person organization, you got a product and engineering and a design person or some matrix of people reporting to you like that, and then you tell them to get into a room and figure out the prioritization, you just didn't do your job. And I'm harping on this because I see it. I saw it over and over in my own career and as major CEO failing, and I see it continue to this day.
I mean, and I think it comes down to the point that you've made very often on this podcast and even earlier this episode is, we need more CEOs who come from backgrounds where they have strong product engineering understanding. And in many cases still today, the CEO is not coming from an engineering or product background. They're coming from sales and marketing, and understandably so, because those have driven those businesses to success. But I think there's a whole host of companies today for which that just doesn't work anymore.
I agree. I think it still works for a large set. And I think at a certain scale, like a very good example here is, I think on its current, let's go back to Salesforce and give it credit. On its current course and speed, product does not define Salesforce anymore. It's all going to be about distribution. It's going to be about marketing. It's going to be about positioning and narrative in the market. Like, you don't need a creative person to become the CEO of Salesforce. And I don't mean this as a dismissive. You just don't. It's already that company. And if it doesn't do anything, it's going to be 20% year over year. 25, 30% year over year. You do not need a creative person. But look at Microsoft when Satya took over. If you put a sales and marketing, and sales and marketing got it into that position with Steve Ballmer, if you put a sales and marketing person in charge of that, now Satya is a product person. He's not really an engineering person, but he was as close as you were going to get inside of Microsoft to that. If you put a sales and marketing person in charge of Microsoft, we wouldn't be having a conversation about Microsoft these days. Satya is the reason why, and he's the closest example I think you have in the industry at the moment.
I think that's a great place to end today's episode on, Jason. Are there any parting words, final words that you want to add to today?
I think that this is a really fun podcast in many ways because we got to talk about some of the things that annoy us or we got gripes with, stuff like that. The interesting thing is I still think the trend line is going in the right direction. I just don't think we're going fast enough. I think that 10 years ago, I would never get calls for CEO jobs. I get calls every week now for CEO jobs. And I think that that will only continue for people like me in the industry as they have more experience. I'm in my early 40s, and someone in their late 20s, early 30s, 10 years from now, who is a similar background to me, likely is going to be running Google or Oracle or something like that and trying to turn Oracle around or take Google from kind of like a flat line to an up curve. And I think that'll be fun. I think that's the right trend line. And I hope that we see more of those folks in the industry take over companies.
Yeah, I hope so as well. And I think you're absolutely right. Like one of the things that just lives in the nature of engineers and engineering leaders is to constantly improve the environment in which we work. Well, the rate of change that we want is never going to be high enough knowing how critical you and I are. But in its nature, we have continued to improve. And I think I'm excited to see, like, besides all these, I'm really excited to see where we're going to end up in. And I think that's also maybe a bit of foreshadowing to a future episode that Jason and I need to do on, like, you know, what does the future look like in 20 years?
And one more thing I'll add. My wife and I just had this conversation this week because I think it was a difference in our personalities on a specific topic. But she was talking about something and she said, hey, you don't ever seem satisfied with what you have. And it feels like goalposts moving. And I said, no. It's actually not goalposts moving. It's not any of those things. It's more of a, hey, this is all working. But I know that there's a 10% over here that is suboptimal or broken. And so instead of focusing on what I know is working, or at least to a higher degree than the other, I then turn my attention and the aperture of opens up to 100% on that. So what it feels like to somebody else is that I'm already not grateful or X, Y, or Z over here. But in fact, what it is it's working. So I'm going to turn my attention over here. That's the difference between engineering mindset and non-engineering mindset, in my opinion. And I think that's what it takes to run companies.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more with you, Jason. And I think probably it leads to a final irk that we can have people think about is we should probably celebrate our successes more in engineering than we do today. And it's because of this mindset that we don't.
Thank you for listening to Developing Leadership. Make sure you subscribe to follow us on our journey towards more meaningful engineering leadership. If you have any challenges or topics you would like us to explore in an upcoming episode, go to developingleadership.co to submit them. To learn more about data-enabled engineering and how metrics can help your teams and improve your processes, go to athenian.co. See you in 2 weeks for another episode of Developing Leadership.